Here's a few things from chapters 7 and 8, the chapters on memory. Just like perception, memory is active. It's not passive. It, like perception, updates, elaborates, fills in gaps. Unlike perception, since memory is concerned about the past, it goes back and revises the past, or at least our memory of the past is a revision of what we've experienced often. And sometimes it just clearly invents new things. Three stages of memory. One is the encoding stage, and then there's the storage stage. In the encoding stage, that occurs when we actually perceive something. So we're feeling something, we have a perception, we see the car. During that perception event, the memory gets encoded, and then it gets stored. And two things that occur at the storing stage are elaboration and revision. So memory fills in gaps, and memory revises things in order to make it consistent with what we believe and what we've already experienced. Retrieval stage is when we actually remember something. So two kinds of retrieval. One is recall and the other is recognition. In recall, we actually bring something up from memory. So the example of recall is the police sketch artist who is asking the witness to describe what they experience, to describe what they perceive. And the witness has to bring all that stuff up from memory. And there's nothing for the witness to look at to say that was the one. The witness has to describe it. In recognition, that's like the lineup or the case where the police have all the photos of past criminals, and they're flipping through the book and asking the witness to recognize any of those. So in recognition, the person actually has to recognize something that's in front of them. Elaboration and revision. Here are six cases that the book talks about to describe elaboration and revision. Remember the incident with the ants. The person's told a story, and the story has something about the ants ate the jelly, and also a line that said the ants were in the kitchen. And most people remember the story containing a sentence that said the ants ate the jelly in the kitchen, although it wasn't there. It's just a natural leap to make, but they'll remember it being in the story when it's not there. The case of the dictator. People are told a story about a particular dictator, and the dictator in the story was named Gerald Martin, and so on. Dictator in another story, Adolf Hitler, of course, and so on, and people will fill in details in the story to make it consistent with facts that they know about Hitler. The grad student's office, this is a person who's brought into an office, they're told it's a grad student's office, the office is empty, no books in the office. Later they'll remember the office as containing lots of books. Again, they fill in the details. Their memory process adds the memory of all these books to make it consistent with what they believe about offices of graduate students. In the labels experiment, people are shown certain figures, and then later they're asked, the figures are sort of ambiguous, if you remember. Later they're asked to draw the figure of a blank, and in the case one of the figures looks like it could either be a barbell or some eyeglasses, and if they're shown to draw the figure of the eyeglasses, they'll make it look more like eyeglasses. If they're asked to draw the figure of the barbell, they'll end up making it more like a barbell. Betty Kay, that's they're told a story about this woman named Betty Kay, and later they're told about something else about Betty Kay. Say one thing that they were told. One group was told that she ended up getting married. The other was told that she was a lesbian. And then they added certain components to the story to make it consistent with what they believed about those two claims. In the case of the lecture, here was a case where a lecturer went in, gave a lecture to the class, and again later the class was told that the person was a graduate student, assistant professor, associate professor, so on, then asked to describe them. And it turned out the person got taller and taller with every promotion in rank. Okay, revising our past attitudes. We tend to go back and make us seem more consistent in the past. So this is especially true with, obviously, people who have lived longer. So parents, thinking back at their college days, they remember their early attitudes and beliefs in ways that make them consistent with their present attitudes and belief. So on, let's say, cases of drug use in college or political views, are they liberal, conservative, so on, they'll remember being pretty much like they are now. Well, this makes us feel consistent, like we always believed this all along, we were always, but right now, we've always been right, so on. It also, the danger here is that it makes us very wrong about predicting our future views, so that we have a tendency to think that because we haven't changed very much over the years, we'll never change very much over the future. But our belief that we haven't changed very much over the years is very often wrong. Retrieval. One way that we can affect retrieval is just how we ask the questions that are used to elicit information from people. So one experiment asked a group of people, how frequently do you have headaches? And the people who were asked that question had an average answer of 2.2 headaches a week. The people who were asked the question, if you have headaches, how often do you have them, their average response was 0.7 headaches a week. So notice here, it's just a matter of the wording of the question. There's an assumption built in. The assumption in the first question, how frequently do you have headaches, is that you do in fact have headaches, and maybe you have them fairly often. That assumption isn't in the second question. So that really affected how people remembered their headaches. Now, think about how this could be used for better or for worse. One clear application is in the case of the law. So a lawyer has a witness. The lawyer is either wants to prosecute the defendant or defend the defendant. So the lawyer has an obvious vested interest in getting certain responses from the witness. And a good lawyer will know how to ask the right questions that are more likely to get the response that the lawyer wants. Okay. Retrieval works in several ways. Retrieval is context dependent, it's state dependent, and mood congruent. Context dependency means that you are more likely to be able to retrieve a particular memory in the same, if you are in the same context as you were when you had that perception. For instance, it's been shown that students who are taking a test in class will do better if they take the test in a classroom, the same classroom as they heard the lecture. State dependency. Retrieval is our ability to retrieve information is determined by not just the context, but the state we were in when we experienced it. So things like if you learn some information and you had some coffee that day, so you had a certain amount of caffeine, well, it will be easier for you to retrieve the information if you or in the same condition. A retrieval is also mood congruent. That means what we remember tends to match up with our mood. So if you are depressed, you tend to remember bad things. If you are feeling pretty happy, you tend not to remember so much the bad things that happened to you in the past. Memory schemas. A schema is a set of knowledge, beliefs, all these sort of basic facts about particular kinds of things. So you can think of a schema as a kind of framework or pattern. So these things are generally like this. So the example is the graduate student's office and the one experiment. Well, I have a particular schema. I've got a set of knowledge and a set of beliefs that generally apply to things like this. Not always, but generally. So graduate student offices are generally full of books because they're working on papers, working on a dissertation, so on like that. Schemas influence the way we perceive things. Our perception tends to, we use our schemas to fill in the gaps, to filter certain things out. Schemas affect our expectations. Given that we believe that things are like this, we expect them to be like that. Schemas affect our inferences, and they also affect our memory. So here are all the factors that go into revising memories. One factor is obvious: inferences. Here's a case for the ants. If it was the case that the ants were in the kitchen and it's the case that they ate the jelly, then it's likely to be the case that they ate the jelly in the kitchen. Common knowledge, Hitler. Okay, people elaborated the story to include that the dictator hated the Jews. Well, that comes from this common knowledge about Adolf Hitler. Expectations, again, just talked about that, the student office. We revise memory on the basis of certain labels and concepts that are applied to certain things. And that's the experiment with the labeled figures. Stereotypes, in the case of Betty Kay. Information that we're given. So once we're told that the speaker is a assistant professor, associate professor, full professor, then we revise our memory on the basis of that information. Current attitudes and beliefs, parents' memory of their past political views. Current moods, here's the case of if we're in a state of depression, we're more likely to remember all the bad things because they go along, they fit nicely with our current state. Retrieval cues. Here's the case of the person taking the test in the classroom. If it's in a different classroom, they won't be able to remember as much as if it's the same classroom. It's also another example is when you can't find something. You can't remember where you laid it, and somebody asks you, well, where were you when you had it last, or when you knew that you had it last? The idea there is, well, if you go back to that place, then something there might trigger your memory. Something there will give you a retrieval cue that will let you bring it back up. And framing effects. In the book, that's the case of the people who are shown a video, and in the video there's a car that has a wreck, right? Two cars have a wreck, and then later people are asked the question, how fast were the cars going when they blanked into each other? So if you ask the question smashed into each other, you get a high response. If you ask the same question with different words, how fast were the cars going when they contacted each other, when they skidded into each other, whatever, you'll get different speeds, and it's all determined by how the question is asked. Okay, moving on. I believe this is in the next chapter, in source misattribution. Source misattribution is the case where we remember something, but we forget where we learned it. So people are always saying that so and so told me this. Well, that may be the case that somebody else told them that. Two consequences from source misattribution is one, plagiarism. So sometimes we'll think that it's our own idea, but it turns out that we got it from somebody else. We just couldn't remember that we actually got it from somebody else. So we may very likely pass this off in a paper as being, this is my own idea, when it's really not, when I really did get it from someone else. So that's something you have to be careful of. The other thing is to believe something and be fairly confident in the truth of this particular belief because you thought you got it from a reliable source. But because of source misattribution, it may be the case that we got it from somebody that we know is a particularly unreliable source, and we're just confused about what our source is. And if we could remember that we got it from an unreliable source, we wouldn't be nearly as confident in the belief. Misinformation effect. If later on we are given some pretty subtle misinformation, that can cause us to misremember certain facts about the event. One example is the people who are shown a video, and in the video is a stop sign. And the stop sign's not the main feature of the video here, but later on people are asked about the event, and as they're asked, the event is described as containing a yield sign. People are more likely to remember seeing a yield sign than a stop sign. Or people were shown a video, and the video had eight demonstrators, and they're asked, was the leader of the 12 demonstrators a male? And then later on, people who are asked that question will remember there being, on average, nine demonstrators. If people were asked, was the leader of the group of four demonstrators a male? Later on, they'll remember an average of 6.4 demonstrators. So the misinformation affected that the way that they remember the event. This is something that I think is particularly interesting. It turns out that the vividness of the memory and the confidence that we have in a memory is in no way a reliable guarantee of the memory's accuracy. So there are certain events called flashbulb events. And a flashbulb event is one that is so vivid that when we remember it, we can remember it. The details we that the particular situation that we were in when we heard that the event occurred. So the classic event now, actually the classic event in the past was the assassination of JFK. But I'm sure that now what will be called the classic flashbulb event is when the World Trade Center went down on 9/11. After one of these events, the particular event was the explosion of the Challenger spaceship or space shuttle. A professor asked a fairly large class to write down the day after the event what circumstances they were in, just what were they doing when they first learned about it. And then 2.5 years later, they're asked to again, describe the circumstances they were in, what they were doing when they heard about the explosion of the space shuttle. Well, over one third of them were very wrong in the details. Another one third got some of the important details wrong. So, well over half of the people were mistaken in their memory, even though they're very, very confident that their memory is true. In fact, they were so confident in the truth of their memory that they made up some story about why their memory was right, but their original story, when they were shown how the original piece of writing that they didn't match up to their memory. They made up a story about how their memory was right, and the thing that they wrote the day after it occurred was wrong. Look at the text on false memories, because that's particularly interesting and important. So, a lot of stuff about false memories, some good experience, good good experiments about false memories. A false memory is not simply one that is somewhat wrong in the details, but here's a person that remembers an event, or at least seems to remember an event. They're confident that they remember an event, but nothing like that event ever occurred. And this usually occurs with things that happened in childhood, so on. It's important today mainly because there's something called false memory syndrome, where it's some good experiments showing how easy it is to get people to seem to remember things that never happened. And it applies to cases where someone has repressed a certain memory, and a memory of a traumatic event. Later they under therapy have remembered this. Well, the question is this really a case of a repressed memory, a true repressed memory, or is it a case of false memory syndrome? Sometimes we don't remember the past well because we have good reason not to remember it well. In the case of a traumatic event, it could simply be a defense mechanism, and we're repressing that particular memory. It could be a case where I've done something that I'm not particularly proud of, so I'm going to reconstruct the past in a way that makes me seem a lot better than what I was. Even if we can be shown that something's faulty with a memory, it's really hard to get rid of it. Belief perseveration is this tendency for a person to keep a belief even after the evidence for that belief is undermined. Another thing to keep in mind is inert knowledge. Even after you learn something, it's sometimes very hard to have access to that knowledge. So inert knowledge is knowledge that you have, but you can't really use when you need it. So have you ever been in a situation where you've learned something that would help you out a lot, but then when you needed it, you couldn't think of it at all? So you just go about doing. Let's say you learned a new way to do something that is a much more efficient, much easier way to perform a particular task. And then when you're faced with doing that task, you just keep doing it the same old way. That's a case of inert knowledge. You've got new knowledge, but you can't bring it up when you need it. Eyewitness testimony is a great example that pulls a lot of this stuff together, especially stuff from perception and the case of memory. So the person was an eyewitness. They're asked to describe what they saw, and a lot of things can affect eyewitness testimony, whether or not it's reliable. So, you know, eyewitness testimony is prone to those framing effects. So how does the lawyer ask the question? That will influence the way that the person remembers it. Eyewitness testimony eyewitnesses are very often asked to remember things that were important, but they didn't realize were important at the time. So when they remember, when they have the memory, when they actually retrieve it, their mind is filling in a lot of those trivial details, and so they may very well be reporting things that were not part of the original perception, but were part of the elaboration or the revision that memory did when it stored it. Primacy and recency effects. The primacy effect is this tendency that we have to remember the first things in a series. Recency effect is the tendency that we have to remember the last things in a particular series. So, do you tend to remember the first things that happened to you or the last things that happened to you? Well, it sort of depends on the situation. It turns out when people are involved, their primacy effect seems to hold. So that's one reason why first impressions are so strong. The first impression you have of someone greatly influences how you what you remember about that person, and then what you remember about that person influences what you continue to believe about that person and so on. And given belief perseveration, it's very, very difficult then to undermine those initial impressions. So you remember the initial impression. That initial impression leads you to a belief about this person's character. And then no matter how much evidence you get about that being wrong, it tends to stick with you. Well, that's it for memory. There's a lot of stuff in the textbook, so go back and look at that textbook, read it fairly closely, and it's got some really interesting things.